This podcast is brought to you by sarahraven.com, which is home to everything you need for a truly beautiful and productive garden. You'll also find great and essential gardening kit and stylish, lovely things to have in your house to bring the outside indoors, all inspired by the garden and the house being tied together. There's also plenty of garden inspiration, how-to videos and specialist growing guides. So head over to sarahraven.com today to discover even more. Welcome to Grow, Cook, Eat, Arrange, the podcast of me, Sarah Raven, and various different riveting, lovely guests. And today I actually have two, which is a real treat. I have Adam Nicholson, my husband, who many of you will have heard on the podcast before. And I have Charlie Harper, who is the head gardener at NEP and in charge of the rewilding wall garden there. And that's really what I wanted us all to talk about, which explains why Adam's here, because I feel he definitely knows more about rewilding than I do. And on our much smaller farm of 90 acres at Birch Hill, he has his own small rewilding project. And so I thought he and Charlie would probably have more insightful stuff to say than I would. So that's why it's a three-way conversation today rather than a two-way. So welcome, Charlie, and welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So Adam, will you explain to those who don't know, which I imagine are quite few actually, but possibly our listeners from abroad who don't know about the NEP rewilding project?
Yes, I mean, I feel a bit goofy explaining it to Charlie, who works there. But anyway.
I won't be marking you, don't worry.
Oh, yeah, okay, do, please do. NEP is a wonderful estate in Sussex, not far from Gatwick Airport. And it belongs to Charlie Burrell and his wife, Izzy Tree. And Charlie inherited it as a very young man and for many years, I think something like 17 years, attempted to farm it in a very conventional way, pouring in the chemicals, very heavy-duty wheat one after another, and it lost money hand over fist, and they were tearing their hair out. And decided, I think, Charlie, is that right, about 20 years ago now, is it? Maybe a bit longer, 24 years, is it? Something like that?
It's 24 years, I
24
think,
yeah. years ago, to stop losing money and essentially, and in a quite an incremental way, give nature a chance to reclaim the 3,000 odd acres of NEP. Inspired by a marvellous man, a Dutchman called Frans Vera, who had set up a huge rewilding project on an abandoned polder in Holland called Oostvaardersplassen, where nature had been allowed to go, but controlled and supervised and intervened in by large herds of browsing and grazing animals, cattle and deer and horses, ponies. And the idea being that after the end of the Ice Age, when nature returned to Europe, the old idea was that it was one huge, continuous, shady forest. But Frans Vera's idea, was that these big browsing herds actually disrupted that continuous forest and made it into a mosaic of habitats in which nature thrived. And the closed forest and the closed still static forest is a stable, relatively impoverished world compared with this dynamically changing, browsed, grazed, intervened in storm-damaged mosaic world. And that essentially is what the rewilding has been based on, as I understand it, at NEP, that change and a rolling sense of kind of successive diversities, not a single fixed condition, but one which is always looking in itself for kind of new ways of being. And so the pigs, they have rooted up the sward and all the seed bank that's in the sward and all the invertebrates that like to live on kind of disturbed ground all erupt, and they've had fantastic successes with butterflies, purple emperors, and then also small mammals and bats included that thrive on that. And so the entire sort of staircase of life has been allowed to work there by involving change, not a static, fixed, parky view of what beauty is in nature, but nature's beautiful when it's on the move. That's what I get from Neb.
And then just to really bring Charlie in here, the thing about the walled garden and about Charlie's role there is that that had been carrying on for some time, but the question was the relevance to every person with a garden. And so, you know, the sort of criticism that was thrown at Neb was that it's all right if you've got many thousands of acres. But the point is how you can then ground that into the average person's life and what we can all do as gardeners to do our own mini projects. So, Charlie, is that right? When did the garden start?
Firstly, Adam, that was a very, you put that a lot more eloquently than I could have. That was a really good roundup and introduction to Neb.
I love you too, Charlie, obviously.
Thank you very much. I'm glad that's recorded. So really, we started talking about the garden in 2019. So as Adam said, you know, a lot of change has happened over 24 years in the wider estate at Neb. It's about 3,500 acres. But in the garden, we had this big wall garden at Neb, which was mainly one big croquet lawn. Very, very formal. A lot of lawn, a lot of wide open gravel paths that were sort of flamethrowered to keep them weed free and immaculate. And I guess the funny thing was that all of that effort has gone into creating these mosaics of different habitats in the wider landscape. But in the garden, which we as gardeners know should be such havens for wildlife, should offer so much opportunity, it was really back at, well, ground zero, I guess. It's a very flat landscape with a monoculture of a few different, mainly grass species. So the question was asked, then how do you, as you say, it's having, not everyone has 3,500 acres, but 88% of households in the UK have a garden of some description, which is a lot. So if it means that if we can work out exactly what was going on in the wider landscape to bring all of that that wildlife back, What can we take from that and put it into a garden? So the question was, can you and how do you rewild a garden? So that was the sort of starting question.
Yeah. And so what you did is you went back to a clean slate, didn't you? And, I mean, will you start talking about the edible section? Because I know that's on the south face of the greenhouse, which divides the wall garden, doesn't it, into two parts.
Can I just ask a kind of even more basic question? Which is that people assume that a garden is a place where that you kind of control and design and impose. And the whole essence of rewilding is to have no final goal, really, but to allow natural processes to evolve on their own. And so for many, I imagine, and perhaps for me even, the idea of a wilded or rewilded garden has such a kind of core self-contradiction that it's difficult to know where to go with that.
It's a very good point, and it does require quite a lot of thinking outside of the box. You know, we're not saying that in a garden, which is a very unique context, these are human-made spaces that we often see as a sort of extension of our homes. It's pure ecological restoration, taking what's outside in the wider landscape at Neb and putting it inside the garden. But it's about seeing what happens and being inspired by that. So there's a lot of people get very excited about the terminology involved. You know, rewilded. What sort of era are we aiming for? You know, what is wild, especially in a British context when our landscapes are so sort of fragmented and farmed? So it is a difficult word, rewilding. But rewilding itself has a definition, and that was first used it was first coined in a practical context in the 1990s, and it was summed up by a couple of Americans called Sule and Noss, referring to restoring natural processes in a world that us humans have largely removed. And it was summed up with the three three C's. So you've got cores, corridors, and carnivores. And the cores being your individual ecosystems, your corridors being the connectivity, the free movement of wildlife between them, and then the carnivores, those are the sort of keystone species which make everything happen in within the cores. So it's about being inspired by what's the natural processes and the mosaics of different habitats that they can throw up and the dynamism involved with that, and placing it into this really strange and quite unique context of a garden. So really what we're doing is we're just learning from what's going on out there, and we, the gardener, within this very unique context, are being inspired by that and adapting our management styles to try and get in that complexity.
And how did you, I mean, I know that you have nearly 1,000 species in under an acre, is that correct? I mean, that's one of the key things, isn't it, is having a huge range of plant types and habitat types, because then, of course, I mean, Jennifer Owen's work in Leicester showed that just letting nature romp without gardening it was one advantage. But actually what you're showing is that by taking care of these huge range of different plants, so it's not just left to random. I mean, you manage it and maintain it in a very, very careful way. So will you describe to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, when I came to NEP, I said that I was going to be head gardener at NEP. Everyone just thought I was going for a long holiday where I could just sit with my feet back. Because the assumption is that you just leave it. Mm. You just leave it completely. And of course, as we know, if you sort of enclose an area from grazing animals in say, as we do occasionally to sort of demonstrate this in the wider landscape at NEP, you get the thugs, really. You get the brambles, and they come through, and then you eventually get sort of closed canopy forest if you were to leave it for a very long time. So you need that kind of disturbance, as Adam said in the introduction, to keep the whole thing sort of dynamic and get that variation. So yes, we garden it very carefully, and it is, you know, we planted this garden in 2021, so it's still a very new garden. We're going into our third season now, and we're learning all the time. We would probably expect there to be a little bit more hands-on time in the earlier years as we're trying to get everything established. And then we are waiting for that variation of structures from the ground layer to the shrub layer to the tree and canopy layer to start to arrive. And then we're just waiting for that sort of balance of competition, I suppose, with the plants that we've got. And I'm sort of hopeful that we'll see a sort of reduction in the amount of time of hands-on time, and they'll be much more sort of observing and seeing how things go and reacting.
But I mean, you didn't leave it to chance what you planted, did you? I mean, I know that you had Tom Stuart Smith as the designer, and then James Hitchmo, who I met when he was doing the huge Olympic site in Southeast London. And then you had Jekka McVicar and Mick Crawley. So you had these advisors all telling you what were the best plants that they knew of for biodiversity. Was that their brief and the most sort of resilient and tolerant?
Yeah. So, I mean, as I said, the first question was, one of the questions was, how do you rewild a garden? But that was, I suppose it's also, how do you maximize biodiversity in a garden? And so that, I suppose, maximum biodiversity is there isn't an end goal, as you say, Adam, but that's what we're aiming for. So I guess there was a focus on plants that weren't sort of sterile hybrids, plants that can seed themselves around and be dynamic. We don't want things that are just going to sort of sit there and not offer nectar and pollen to visiting insects, etc. So I guess there was a lot of thought into more sort of natural, in inverted commas, plants within the mix. But also, you know, it is a garden, and that is it's a unique context there. Gardens should be used and enjoyed. They should be used to grow things that we like to eat, and they should be therapeutic as well. So it's about that balance. And, you know, that you can see we had Tom Stuart Smith, James Hitchmo, and Jekka McVicar, three plants people that you really look up to, who really know their stuff. But you can see, especially in some of the more sort of arid areas of the garden, we've got things like a couple of agave species, Parii, and Vatifolia. And you think, well, what role does that have in a garden in the south of England for wildlife? So there's a sort of, there's still a very gardening-y element of it. It could be because it looks really good. But also, most of these agaves have got ants' nests under them. They sort of burrow in and they make this little ants' nest under, and it sort of gets lifted up the ground, that you could argue that actually that makes the soil underneath more free draining. And so it keeps them alive in these really wet winters. But also there's sort of arachnids basking on the blades in the summer, and it still has a role.
Yeah.
I just thought there must be an interesting question about competition, that obviously if you did let it roll, there would be certain plants that outcompeted the others, and you would end up with a kind of dominance hierarchy in the thing, which presumably you as gardeners are always working to subvert and to reestablish a lovely liberal democracy in there. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's we've drawn up we keep a database of plants that arrive of their own accord, and what we would refer to as weeds, but we keep a record of the sort of ecological role that they can play for us, whether they be a food plant or something that larval insects need to breed on, or maybe they've got a deep taproot to break up the clay, for example. But within that list, there are plants that do a little bit too well because they've kind of got free rein, and they are used to, they really respond well to disturbance. And as gardeners, we keep a close eye on that, and we refer to weeding as grazing. And it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I suppose, but it's a useful image because, much like in the wider estate at NEP or grazing animals in general, they tend to eat or graze off the things that they would like to eat in general. But we as gardeners, as the keystone species in the garden, can make that decision, not necessarily just on what we want to eat. Of course, we can do that, but also whether they are good for biodiversity or bad for biodiversity. And obviously, as you say, there is the competition aspect. If things do a little bit too well and they start to smother other things, then that would arguably be negative for biodiversity. So we can intervene there. And that's exactly what we do. We will graze an area off. We will select the things that we want a bit less of to try and achieve that balance.
And do you have a case meeting where you put the pros and cons of each plant? I mean, do you know what I mean? I used to be a medic, and we would sort of get all our heads together, and people would put different cases for different outcomes. And I just wondered if you have a sort of, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we do. We have not disagreements, but sort of debates. And that might be usually called, my colleague Moy has a particular vengeance with oxeye daisies,
right?
Which I feel just has that really kind of light and airy and abundant look in the sort of midsummer. Mm. But I think she spent quite a lot of time weeding out just, you know, carpets of oxeye daisies. So I can understand that. But
what about the thistles? What happens with the creeping thistles? So they're allowed to creep in and tease. What about all this kind of thing?
Well, all of them are excellent plants for our native insects and birds. Mm. And, you know, I suppose we curate it. As we're a gardener, so we garden it. So occasionally when there is, say, a spear thistle, for example, you know, really important flower structure for a range of invertebrates. And, you know, it's basically a big cardoon. And so we curate it. We let it do its thing. We might sort of remove some of the really spiky lower leaves so they don't encroach on a whole lot of other things. See that as sort of nibbling off as if we were a sort of grazing animal. But we want it to flower. We just go in there with the hedging shears when they're about to seed absolutely everywhere. Yeah. And, you know, just having incidences of these plants dotted around that we are keeping an eye on, we know that we've got that opportunity within the garden. But you could also say, and context and connectivity, that second C of rewilding, the corridors, is to see the garden in its context. And we know that actually we've got the national population of thistles and ragwort and everything just outside the wall garden. You know, there are boom and bust years, but they're certainly there, and we see the seeds eddying around the wall garden in the wind. So, you know, we know that those opportunities are outside, so we see that as part of the corridor. But I still think that they're important, and they're a really good talking point because people see these plants as a real problem, whilst actually they can do so much good, but they do need to be gardened.
So there's a feeling in the end, it might be that it's a kind of light, open, bushy woodland with other annuals and things. There's a grass layer, glower layer. Is that the final idea, that it's something people used to talk about 20, 30 years ago about forest gardening? Is that really what this is?
I mean, that you could call it that. I mean, in the wider estate, we've got this what is referred to as wood pasture, that scrubby landscape where you have scrub which protects canopy species like oaks, and you get natural regeneration because of that. You get this really good variance of vegetation structures. So I guess wood pasture is kind of what you kind of hold as this thing that we need to aim for. But really, we don't know what's going to happen, and we're just going to enjoy just seeing what happens. But there is certainly that variation of structure we know is very important. There's hopping off points for various wildlife. It's that woodland edge habitat that we are sort of striving for. So it would be nice to, I mean, it's hard because I'm seeing what happens, but I guess it would be nice because those are pretty ecologically beneficial instances. So we're just going to see what happens, really. Mm. But it's that variation that we're really interested in.
And for you, what would be like you get up in the morning and walked into the garden and something was there or something happened. What would be your really sort of joyful, triumphant symbols and moments?
I suppose it would just be just observing just a constant drip feed of the abundance of life within the garden. Mm. And, you know, one day we walked in and there were 23 Exmoor ponies in the garden, which was a little bit too much. It was an amazing sight. But we will probably shut the gate a little bit more in future because we're the keystone species within the garden. But it does happen, especially when you're walking in through the sort of paint a really romantic picture, the morning mist, and you come in and you see the wagtail sort of bobbing up and down in the ephemeral pond in the middle, or, you know, hummingbird hawk moss, which we see a lot of at the moment. Just seeing that abundance of life, and what's really exciting is the unexpected. This is a, you know, Tom, when he designed this garden, said it was sort of like a box of unpredictabilities. And that's really exciting as a gardener, because it sort of frees you slightly, and just know that you have to make, we're just making informed decisions as gardeners using our observations and you know, training or not, to make informed decisions.
Mm. And what is the kind of aesthetic dimension of that? You know, what do you need it to look a certain way, or is it okay if the natural processes do their own thing?
Well, that's people ask this. There is certainly an aesthetic element to it. You know, as we're gardeners, and I think it's important that they're enjoyed. But what I find is really stimulating all the time is the diversity. So I guess we are driven by that. If there's sort of too much of one thing, we might intervene. But it's that variation. And we had a visitor yesterday seeing the garden in this. In March, in after the wettest February on record, and where everything is just sort of quite sopping and a little bit miserable looking, he still said that it was beautiful because you've got that variation even in the sort of dead structure, and that's what we would really strive to. But obviously, we're gardeners. There are some plants that we really like and we get really excited about. So it's about enjoying those moments too and making those happen.
Well, when we went there, was it in the summer? It felt, the thing I left feeling was it was fantastically explorable.
Yeah.
That it had lovely, a surprise really, hidden around corners. And the idea that you would find another little environment, pond environment, pondside environment, dry environment. You never knew what was coming next. And so unlike, you know, most gardens where really it lays it out in rather a kind of blank and dreary way. This garden, I did feel you could shrink into it, so to speak. It would grow around you as you got to know it. And I thought that was very beautiful.
And the architecture and the structure, I mean, I remember you explaining to us, Charlie, that you allow self-seeding, but you also want to retain some feeling of a path so that people are led in a direction, but in a very, very gentle way. So everything is through gravel, which is seeded into, but that is edited a little bit so that there is a little bit of direction, but very quietly done, basically.
That's right. It's not a shouty garden, is it? And that is a lovely quality. The whispering garden at NEP, we now call it.
Fantastic. I like that very much.
So, I mean, you started with 900 or nearly 1,000 species, and I'm really interested to know where you feel sort of 3-4 years on you've ended up. I mean, is the species count going up or is it going down because, you know, certain things thrive and et cetera, and you're editing? Where have you ended up?
It hasn't changed that much because, and this is one of the facts of life in a sort of functioning ecosystem. Some things don't do so well. The idea with this whole project is that we make as many different mosaic pieces in this garden mosaic as possible to grow as wide a range of plants as possible. But say in the first summer, we had 4 months of no rain and 40 degree heat. And then we went into a wet autumn and then a winter of sort of down to minus 12 for a week. So a lot of things, and actually quite a lot of the things that had been in the garden historically that were still knocking about, sort of semi-tender euphorbias, things like that, died right back down to the ground. They were really hit hard. But also there are some things that were sort of on the tender fence, I suppose, that just really didn't like it. So they went out. We know that they're probably not going to work in this garden, and we accept that, and we move on. And then we try other things. So we go to plant fairs and do our research a little bit and try and find things that will be ecologically beneficial and things that might fit in this landscape that we've created for them. So it's on a bit of a balance, but that will change as the garden starts to sink into itself.
And to bring it sort of down to the very sort of usual sized back garden that, as you say, 88% of us live with, would you have three to five plants that you would feel that we should all consider growing that perhaps we're not, you know, so not a buddleia, which we all kind of know about, but perhaps three or four more unusual things?
So I suppose if rather than sort of listing some plants that I would grow, because it sort of, you know, really does change on, it depends a lot on context, is to think about succession through the year. So especially at this time of year, having, and we haven't talked about native species and non-native species in great depth at the moment, but it's good to have a mix to cater for, you know, specific insects. Associations, for example, but also to create a resilient garden. So if I was thinking about the early season, currently in the garden, we've got lots of primula. We've got cowslips, for example, out at the moment, and they seed themselves around really well and, you know, provide an early season nectar source. And then going through, I guess we've got a lot of things like dianthus, a couple of dianthus species, which They're not uncommon now in a garden setting, but they do really well. They seed themselves around, and it's the hummingbird hawk moss that we see a lot on those. And then going forward, you've got things like Achillea species, which are just a really good doers and a big sort of dinner plate of a daisy. And then grasses are very important as well. And actually, you know, we quite a lot of the really beneficial grasses in for our native insects are sort of native meadow grasses, and you know, we allow those to sort of seed themselves around in the garden, but they also, you know, more ornamental grasses provide good cover for a range of wildlife right through the season into, you know, one particular star plant which does really well on our really free draining substrate, which is actually, it's a mix of 75% crushed concrete, 25% sand, so really harsh. We've got things like Buchaea purpurea, which is a really sort of thistly daisy from South Africa, which sort of seems to flower right the way through the year. So yeah, I would say, to round up, I'd say think about that season. Try and pack in the opportunity throughout the year and get that mix of native species and non-native species.
So you wanted to ask a question, Adam?
Well, I mean, I think that Charlie's just answered it, really, that if you can get that succession and you get that variety and you get that attention to the needs of the whole kind of range of all the trophic levels, then that will do it on a small scale. And this other thing, that when Steve Head was here the other day talking about integrating your street so that some parts of the street attend to this and others to that, and your variety of environments that you have in the NEP garden could be distributed through the back gardens of a street.
Yeah.
And that's a really beautiful idea, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So one person has the pond and one person the dry and one person the shady and one person the
exactly.
Wet. Yeah.
Exactly. It's a wider mosaic, and thinking about not just your isolated situation is really, really important. Because that's how, even if you've just got a, you know, when I moved, before I moved down to NEP, I lived in North London and had a balcony, but still that's a really important stepping stone, and it connects up to next door and then to the tree pits on the street, to the park down the road. This is how it all adds up. So thinking about the connectivity overall and seeing what we offer as mosaic pieces, you know, to form one big mosaic of opportunities is really important. And it's also freeing in the sense that, you know, people get very excited about rewilding because they either see it as neglect or they see it as an affront to everything they've ever learned about horticulture. And it shouldn't be that way. It's sort of new and trendy and, you know, all the rest. But really, we're making informed decisions as gardeners, and with looking at everything as a mosaic, which really, if you think about it, opens up opportunities for pretty much anything. I'd probably draw the line at sort of plastic grass and using chemicals. But, you know, if you want to have a bit of mown lawn, that's great. That would be a tailored situation for a range of different wildlife. You know, so we're not saying sort of kill your lawn or anything like that. It's actually a very inclusive way to think about it.
Yeah, it's very forgiving.
The word is such a trap, isn't it? It's not really rewilding this because it's incredibly high culture.
Yes.
It's renaturing, isn't it? It's actually substituting for the dead croquet lawn a version of nature. And it's not wild because it's human made and human cared for.
And as Charlie says, it's all about beauty and about the sensory experience and the sort of solace and, you know, everything, but enhanced because it's a garden rather than nature.
The very best of rewilding is in a garden.
Very good. And how do people visit, Charlie, just before we finish?
So people can visit in a number of different ways. We have a number of different tours and workshops available through all bookable through the NEP website. You can come on a private tour and we'll show you around. We've got open days on Friday, first two Fridays of the month. We're open for the National Garden Scheme. We have got workshops in the planting of the garden, in the monitoring of the garden, as in monitoring wildlife, with Kate Bradbury, who we might have read many of her books and seen her on Gardener's World. We've got ecology tours with ecologists to go around and look at, you know, wildlife in detail. And we've also got a workshop in the managing as well, because there is quite a lot of management. It's not just hands off. So we've got lots of different options.
Fabulous. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Adam. I hope you all found that as interesting as I did.
I did.
I'm glad.
Thanks, Charlie, so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to an interesting, I found it really interesting, discussion between Adam, Charlie Harper from NEP, and myself. And yeah, next week is really interesting too. I'm joined by Ollie Hudson, who is the head kitchen gardener of the Pig Group of Hotels. And they are known for their veg gardens, and they are really amazing. They're fantastically productive, but also very ornamental. And certainly that's where I head when I first go to a pig hotel. I go and see what they're growing, and they do have a lot of food from their garden onto the plate. So join me next week where I'm chatting to Ollie. You can find more information, photos, and advice sheets on all the plants and recipes we talk about on this podcast by heading to the show notes or at sarahraven.com/podcast.